Welcome to another episode of the Middle West Podcast. I'm your host, Thaqib Musa. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you all. We're doing our third episode on the coronavirus, where we're covering various aspects of it. And I'm joined by my co-host, remotely dialing in from his very colorful and very professional work-from-home environment, Abdussemi Arjumand.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone. How's it going? It's been a long time. It's been a long time indeed.
You know, our listeners can't actually reply to you, right?
You know what? Thank God I'm saying this, because usually I say viewers as well, right, whenever I'm hosting.
Well, we're not quite doing video yet. We're not quite there yet. We also have another co-host, Ahmed Swalhi. And today we're joined by the Director of Public Health for Birmingham City Council, Dr. Justin Varney. Hello, Doctor. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure. Happy to be here.
So we're all kind of, again, remotely doing everything. Our listeners can probably tell from the audio quality and possibly bits of reverb that I may or may not be able to edit out.
Stay at home, guys. It's all about staying at home.
Yeah, so I wanted to start off the conversation with public health. So I'm from an engineering background, and one of the things that always is public health. What is that? It seems like a very broad term. So what does it mean? What does your job title really entail?
Sure. So probably the easiest way of describing it is I trained as a GP before I came into public health medicine. And in the same way that I trained to treat a patient, to analyze what they're telling me and look at that and work out what disease they've got and what treatment, I now do the same thing, but I do it for a city of 1.1 million people. So it's a similar kind of type of medicine in that I'm looking at a population rather than a person, but I'm looking at the data, I'm looking at the evidence, and then trying to diagnose what's wrong with them and come up with some solutions. That's probably the easiest way of describing it. The other way of thinking about it is I'm a bit like the cultural attaché for the health service, in that a lot of what I do you don't see. Every now and again you see a big campaign or initiative, but I know a lot of people, and I've kind of got the black book that everyone wants when disasters happen. And a small bit of my training, my job, usually is around infectious disease prevention, what's called health protection. And so I trained for outbreaks like this. I just bluntly never thought it would happen. So now all of that training is rolling out, and we suddenly come out and everyone goes, oh, public health, here to kind of save the day.
So on a normal non-COVID-19 situation, when you're kind of advising or planning for things, what sort of things are you kind of looking out for?
Sure. So in a kind of normal non-COVID week, I do all sorts of things. I manage a budget of around £90 million for the City of Birmingham. So I commission things like sexual health services, drug and alcohol treatment services. I run campaigns around promoting physical activity. We've had a whole program on creating a healthy food city for a while, for example. So there's all sorts of things like that. Obviously, during COVID, we've moved into a different way of working, and my team's been completely kind of restructured into response cells, focusing on engaging communities, focusing on crunching the numbers and data, and looking at how we move to ensure that people stay healthy when they're at home.
So, well, coming to crunching the numbers and stuff is one of the questions is that a lot of the numbers that are coming out, there's a, I think, twice a day update nearly on the government websites with the numbers of the latest cases and the number of deaths and things like that. It's been climbing very quickly and alarmingly. How are those numbers calculated, especially where we have cases of a lot of people who may have corona, but they're actually told not to report into a hospital unless it's very, very serious?
No, it's a really good question. There are two key sets of numbers that are reported daily. So one is the number of cases. So that's people who've had a test for coronavirus and have tested positive. And in general, for the last couple of weeks now, you only get a test for coronavirus if you're sick enough to go into hospital. And that's because it changes the way we manage you in hospital. It's also about infection control in hospital, to stop coronavirus spreading in hospital. So that's why we focus those tests really on the hospital at the moment. And as everyone knows, there's been a supply chain issue in getting the chemicals we need from Europe to do the tests. The second data that's reported is the number of deaths that are due to coronavirus. Now, it's important to know that it can take up to 28 days for a death to be certified. So there are two different bits of death data. There's the deaths from hospitals, the people that die in hospital who've tested positive for coronavirus. And that's what you see reported every day on the news. And it's reported by hospital trust, not by where people live. And then the second death data is reported once a week, and that's based on death certificates. And there's about a five to nine day lag between the hospital data and the death certificate data. And that's because there are various bits of paper that have to be filled in for it to become a death certificate. So you've got the testing data, which tells us really the numbers of people going into hospital who test positive for coronavirus, and the death data. And when we think about how that tracks, you know, people talk about curves and going up the curve towards the peak. We know that the death peak tracks about 10 days to 2 to 3 weeks after the case peak. So that's what we would expect, is to have a kind of peak of cases and then a peak of deaths.
Okay, so at the moment, the number of cases is probably much higher than the number we actually know, right? I mean, assuming a 1%, if we're at 7,000 deaths today, that means there's 700,000 deaths. Sorry, 700,000 cases.
Yeah. So what we're seeing is the tip of the iceberg from the cases that present to hospital. Does that matter? Probably not hugely, because in effect, our view's the same. We're seeing the same tip. It's always going. It has been for now 3 or 4 weeks. We're only getting tests from hospital. So the view hasn't really changed. The question is that iceberg changing? And it does seem to be growing bigger. And if the tip's growing bigger, then everything that we can't see under the water is growing bigger as well. So it's reasonable to just track on that basis.
You mentioned the same curve and flattening the curve. And of course, we just talked about different sets of data at the moment, such as, you know, the number of cases, which is around 65,000 as of yesterday, number of deaths, you know, close to 7,000 or close to 8,000 as of yesterday. For the public, what's like the most what is the most important data? Like, what is the data that tells us whether or not we're going, you know, we're coming out of it, or the problem's getting worse? So, what is the curve exactly? What is
sure?
Or what is it?
Yeah. So I think there are two things that I watch most closely. One is the rate. So that's the number of cases per 100,000 population, and that has been going up steadily. And it's really important to look at that rather than the absolute numbers, because, you know, Birmingham's the largest city in the United Kingdom. So because in London you have 32 local authorities, so their data is broken down 32 ways, whereas in Birmingham we're one great big city and one set of data. So we will always have the biggest number of anything, even if the absolute percentage or rate is much lower. So we currently have the third highest rate in the West Midlands and the third highest rate in the core city, so the cities outside London. And we're tracking behind London in general, about 10 days behind London in terms of where they are.
Would it be Manchester curve. Is even further behind us, and kind of the further you get?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so ahead of us at the moment, Sheffield and Newcastle are ahead of Birmingham. Behind Birmingham, close runner-up is Liverpool. And then Manchester, Bristol, and the other core cities. So there, and some of that we think is probably because you know, Birmingham's got a huge flow of people backwards and forwards from London. You know, I've certainly got friends that work in London and live in Birmingham,
yeah,
and we're commuting backwards and forwards every day. We've also got an international airport, which had lots of flights coming from parts of Europe that were really affected. So it's not surprising where we're tracking. We're definitely tracking up the curve at the moment. And what we would expect is to get to a point where we get to high numbers. Those high numbers then last possibly for a week or two, which suggests we've got to the top of the curve, but we're not coming down yet. And then we'd start to come down. The whole kind of curve bit probably will last to minimum 6 to 8 weeks. And I don't think there will be realistically any relaxation of lockdown or any of the other procedures until we get decent evidence that we're coming down the slope. And that would be based predominantly on the death data rather than, I think, the testing data.
We're focusing at the moment on the COVID-19 deaths and the mortality rate. I was wondering whether the lockdown could have an effect, a knock-on effect on other health services. So, of course, we know that COVID isn't the only killer of patients out there. There's, you know, different health conditions that are, you could say, equally as dangerous. But what do you see as the effect of such our response in the UK, especially on other health services? So, for example, cancer services or emergency services. Do you feel that an extended lockdown would have an effect on that?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly will. And one of the things we're already doing work on is to model that. I mean, I should say we are tracking other things as well as the deaths and the cases. So there's very close monitoring of the number of patients in hospital who require oxygen, who are in intensive care. Some of that's about planning capacity, but some of it's also about planning severity. And we're also tracking overall admissions to hospital to look at A&E usage, for example, and how that's changing. And do we think that's because people are staying at home when they shouldn't? And when they do present, they present later? Or is it because actually the people that didn't need to go to A&E anyway have stopped going, which would be a good thing? Particularly, you raised the point about cancer, which is a really important one. So the NHS, in order to free up bed capacity and protect those critical care beds, did a piece of work several weeks ago to defer any elective surgery. So anyone that was due for a hip operation in the next 6 months would have had it rescheduled. And a whole load of other surgery, if it wasn't considered life-saving, it's been deferred. In cancer, there's been a similar approach to some of the oncology treatment, but it's been based on what clinicians think, based on the individual and the evidence, will happen to their cancer if they don't have treatment for the next 4 to 6 weeks. So there's that kind of piece that's been done around treating people. The other knock on this will have, which I think we are just starting to model through, is obviously people won't be getting mammograms. They won't be getting some of the other cancer screening that we would routinely do. They won't be getting their NHS health checks for the next 5 or 6 months. And so there'll be a load of people that have got disease that isn't found until those are caught up in the autumn or the winter. And there is a very specific piece of work now looking at that to try and model that, but also to plan for how can we get them as fast as possible into their screening so that we aren't losing time. I mean, the reality is for most cancers, the cancer tends to be relatively slow growing. That may or may not make a huge difference for some types of cancer. Similarly for heart disease. You know, so I think there's a kind of weighing up at the moment of how long can we hold people before it really starts becoming a risk again.
When you decided on, or when the decision was made nationally to kind of put the country and minimize people going to work, things like that, so essentially going to lockdown, there was some discussion around if we lock down too early, that might mitigate the effect, or it might not be as good and as effective. What kind of factors went into it when deciding what the optimal time of actually going into lockdown is?
Yeah, I mean, a really good question. Lockdown's not an exact science like engineering, unfortunately. What will have happened at a national level was this weighing up of, at what point do we put the country into lockdown and how hard do we go? And the reason that's weighed up is that the evidence that we know from previous pandemics and from behavioural scientists is that if you lock down, people will tolerate a month, possibly 6 weeks, before they really get bored and start to rebel. And the risk is
14 days is feeling a bit too much for me.
Yeah. Well, and you know, if you've got kids, I know that this is definitely hard at the moment. They've really lost patience. The challenge is when lockdown breaks too early, then you get a second peak. And the evidence from particularly American cities in the 1918 flu pandemic was that cities that broke lockdown early got a second peak that was worse than if they had never locked down in the first place. So the risk is you end up with many, many more people dying if lockdown fails too early. I think the other challenge that we had is that lockdown has huge economic impacts. And you know, everyone listening will be aware of that. You know, people's businesses have gone under. You know, there's huge stress on the economy. And we, you know, we are a relatively small country. We were very reliant on some things from Europe, etc. And this is a global pandemic. And so there was, it is, you know, it is in effect a kind of hedge your bets. At what point do you press the button? I think we probably pressed it about the right time, to be honest, looking at the numbers. But we won't know till it's all over, to be honest.
We're essentially at, I think, with nearly, we're nearly 1,000 a day. And is there a, is that something that was, I mean, it sounds like you're saying that was something that was expected, and actually this was like the bare minimum unavoidable amount. I guess some of it comes down to ultimately maybe we never will know, because every model is, I mean, we have to go with the data, and ultimately you can never really know. But is it, there's a lot of news of people actually breaking the lockdown. And how much of it is, how much of it is just rumors, and how much of it do you think is actually there's some evidence of people actually going out?
So, I mean, the difficult bit, of course, is that we all love to listen to bad news in the media. And it's, you know, there's not great media story in family of eight stay at home for lockdown and do great. You know, that's not what people are putting out in the news. So what you're seeing is reports of relatively small numbers of cases. When we look at the evidence from the police intervention, certainly in the West Midlands, I know that, that it's been very low numbers compared to the population. You know, we've had one or two exceptions. I think the biggest, the hardest bit perhaps of lockdown is bereavement. You know, I think people quite understandably are struggling with not being able to go and see their relatives in hospital who are dying, with not being able to go to a funeral to show their respects. And, you know, that's incredibly hard, and it reflects as a society. We haven't really talked enough about death, frankly, and now it's going to touch all of us in one way or another. You know, and just tonight I will be joining my first virtual funeral through a friend of the family who passed through coronavirus. It's a really difficult time, but that's really where we're seeing it. We're not, I mean, you know, there's the odd student party going on, which is just idiotic, frankly. But in general, the vast majority of the public are doing their bit to save lives and help the NHS. You know, but it's difficult. And as a society, we've never experienced this. You know, I don't think very many people who are still alive now have ever gone through this kind of experience before, because the closest thing to this is World War II, in terms of the way society has had to change. And for most of us, we've only ever read about it or seen it in the movies.
The one thing I wanted to know, kind of going back to the basics of lockdown, what is generally expected of a lockdown, and what is expected of the behavior of the virus itself during a lockdown? And I guess the message on this question is like, and why is it really important and imperative for people to actually stay at home? And how does that actually translate into saving lives?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the easiest way of describing this, I think, is that if you have coronavirus, you on average infect three other people a day. And that's based on interactions. And most people in a normal day interact with 15 people. So just by going to the supermarket, going to the bank, walking out the front door, saying hello, shaking hands, all of that. So those three people then within a day infect three more people. And so you've gone from three to nine, the nine then infect three, etc. So what you get is a very rapid spread of the virus. Now, if that first person stays at home, they don't infect anyone. And I think, you know, the modelling, and I'm not, this is not my expertise in kind of fast maths, but basically you've got a tripling with every contact. And so you very quickly get into thousands of people from that one person walking out their front door. So that's what why we ask people to stay at home. The physical distancing, the 2 meters, is based on this virus is spread in droplets when you cough predominantly. Coronavirus in general doesn't make people sneeze, but it would be the same kind of effect. And when you cough, the little droplets that come out of your mouth, in general, they're quite heavy, so they fall, and they only really go about 2 meters unless you're an absolute champion cougher. So that's why we talk about the 2 meters distance. And then the third thing we talk about is the wash your hands and don't touch your face. And that's because the way the virus gets into your body is that it lands on something, you go and touch it, and then you touch your face. And basically the virus crawls across your face, into your mouth, up your nose or into your eyes. It needs a wet bit of your body to get into. Generally, those are the only bits it can get to easily. And that's how it infects you. So if you're very good at washing your hands before you touch your face and you're not going out, except to do essential shopping or that short period of exercise, you don't present a risk to anyone else, but you also reduce your risk. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I guess one of the things was about we're putting ourselves at risk when we go out for shopping or, you know, for our once a day exercise. And I think there was some, how is this enforced? So is it going to be different city by city? Is it being enforced on a council level? So are police in London going to get different instructions to police in Birmingham? And to what extent is it there's a risk of us going into perhaps kind of draconian measures where I think there was a statement from one of the police chiefs about checking people's trolleys to see if you've bought some chocolate, then that's not
essential. I view chocolate as an essential household product at times. I think it's unlikely we're going to see police checking shopping trolleys, to be honest, but we are increasingly seeing police challenging people, certainly prevents telling people not to sunbathe in parks, not sit around and groups and have chats with their mates, because that doesn't, you know, that's not the idea. The idea is you go out, do a bit of exercise, do your essential shopping, come home. If we get, you know, if that doesn't work, then it will get much stricter. These are national decisions, so all the police forces are working in the same way. You know, we have seen Italy went really hardcore towards the, you know, the middle of the peak. So did Spain. So they had police with sirens going out and telling people to get back inside and all of that. Now, my hope is that the British public have kind of got it now. You know, the numbers of deaths here have risen significantly. More and more of us are touched by this directly and through our social networks. So, I mean, my kind of view is I hope we don't get to that point. Certainly, if they are checking your basket, it's not going to be the diet police.
The thing is, because there's that worry that, you know, we might, you know, will it go to the level where we become a police state? Will we get to the level where on the motorways or even dual carriageways, we're going to have police checkpoints? Is there going to be that worry that, you know, we're going to end up being living in a police state, or do you think it's not going to get to that level?
Yeah, I don't think we're quite a Handmaiden's Tale level yet, frankly. But I do think, you know, it depends a bit on what we all do. We've got to be honest about when we all get out on the doorstep on Thursday nights and clap for the NHS. We have to follow that through with the responsibility to stay at home and do the things government is asking us to. You know, I think the police are very, very reluctant to use the enforcement powers that they have in this space. They're very clear. They're educating, they're encouraging. before they're getting near enforcement. And in the vast majority of cases, that's working. I think the other thing is we need a bit of peer pressure on each other. You know, I'm really disappointed at some of the student parties that I've heard nationally, fortunately not in Birmingham, going on. You know, really stupid. And some of that's because people think they're immune and invincible. And sadly, as you know, we've had young people die in London who had no health conditions, who this virus just went straight through them and sadly killed them. So students are not immune. And you know, that's the real risk, is people make stupid decisions and it costs their lives, but may also cost other people's.
But the good thing is that we're not at the peak, but we're very near to the peak now, which means that hopefully, although the lockdown will last a few more weeks, but hopefully we're on the way to improvement.
So I think we don't know, is the blunt line on this. We think we're climbing the peak. We're definitely not at the peak yet. Whether that's next week or the week after, we won't know really until we get there, to be honest. The challenge is you don't know you're at the peak until you're kind of coming down the other side. It's not like there's a set number or there's a set point where we go, oh, we're almost there, we're almost at the top of the hill. This is the kind of hill that until you're coming down, you don't realise you've come over the top, which is really difficult. And certainly my view is that we'll be in some form of lockdown until at least June.
Mm-hmm. Right, Dr. Vani, just focusing on the effects of the lockdown, going back to that, what have you read or sort of seen as Director of Public Health for Birmingham about the mental health effects of the lockdown, specifically in Birmingham and, you know, in the UK in general?
No, it's a really good question, Ahmed. I mean, I think we are really quite concerned about the mental health effects of this. You know, much as you may love your family and your partner, there's a real difference between choosing to spend time with them and having to spend time with them. There's a lot of work going on at the moment to get more resources out there to support people with the evidence base that we know works. So we know that getting creative, learning something new, doing something that connects you with other people through telephone calls, writing letters, sending cards, those kind of things, being physically active every day, all of those things help people's mental well-being and are evidence-based and are shown to reduce the risk of depression or anxiety, which are the two biggest things that we're likely to see. The other side is that we are, across the country and in Birmingham, like other places, really boosting up bereavement support services. So really looking at how can we help our healthcare professionals who've never had to experience death in this at this scale or in this way. How can we help them to cope? How can we help people who are working way more hours than usual find balance and pace to get through this so they don't come exhausted as well? So there's a lot of stuff going on. Some of it I think is already out there, and you'll see things like the Every Mind Matters campaign from Public Health England that helps people develop a mental health plan. But other things are a bit more subtle. We've been working with our faith communities. So, for example, Easter Monday in the Christian faith is also the Baisakhi festival in the Sikh faith. And we've been working with the Sikh community in Birmingham, the West Midlands, and with the mayor to develop virtual Baisakhi. So you take a selfie, there's a hashtag, and you wear the colours of orange and blue to celebrate the Sikh faith. We're working with our Islamic communities. I meet with the scholars and the masjids every Monday to start to plan for Ramadan. And you know, we won't be celebrating iftar in the same way. We won't be giving food in the same way this Ramadan, because we will be celebrating in the houses in which we live. So there's a lot of thought about both mental health, but also the spiritual support to people as well.
There have been talks of the virtual aid as well.
Yes, and there's a lot of helplines. There's more and more popping up Zoom groups for people, telephone trees, You know, I've had my first Zoom dinner with friends, which has now become a weekly thing. It's a, you know, we've had a tomorrow night. I have, oh, sorry, on Easter Sunday, I have a global Zoom Easter brunch. It's dinner for us in the UK, and it's lunch in America. And we're all crafting Easter bonnets just to make it truly silly and fun. So I think what's great is you see people creative, getting creative and doing all sorts of really fun things and helping to connect. And one of the things we know really helps your own mental health is to give. And giving doesn't necessarily mean giving money. It also means giving of yourself. And the number of people who are reaching out to that person who's on their Facebook page that they never talk to or in their phone and having a chat really does make a difference. And I think, you know, in many ways, we may come out of this a lot stronger than we went in, frankly.
One thing I want to talk about, I just want to know your take on this. One thing that's surprising is whenever I go out for my morning exercise, I always see a lot of old people. And having spoken to a few, they have some another level of kind of, you know, strength. Because you know, the way they see it is, we've lived through the war, so this virus is nothing to us. And so what's your take on this kind of mentality? And I mean, what do you think the current, how do you think the current British public is handling this virus? Do you think as a community or as a, you know, general public, we're much stronger than how it was at the war, or much weaker, or what's your take on this current situation?
I think what's, you know, it is an interesting take because obviously there are older people who did experience the war and they kind of go, you know, this might be an invisible killer. It's not quite a plane going over the head. But we also know what it's like to not be able to go out and to make do at home and make do amend. So, you know, that's great. I think the other thing is that many older people do live alone, live in isolation. They don't go out very often because it's not easy for them, you know, physically. And so they've already adapted to that. You know, Ruby Wax was on something the other day saying it's the introverts in society who kind of everyone else is now joining. That they live their lives, not going out, not going to parties. So they're kind of going, oh, what's new? This is the way we do it anyway. So, you know, I think what's great is that one of the things is we're able to tap into that expertise and go kind of, how do you get through this? You know, and I do think those of us who've still got grandparents that are able to talk to them about it are benefiting from their wisdom. Because it's helpful to just put it in perspective that, you know, and also put it in perspective that in the UK, we're really fortunate. You know, in some countries across the world, this will hit so, so much harder. You only have to look at what's happening in India or Pakistan at the moment in terms of the impact of lockdown on people that are in very low paid jobs, where the whole system is falling apart for them. You know, we still have water running through the taps. We still have electricity to watch Netflix. There is still food in the supermarket. And yes, there is loo roll. You know, we are really blessed in the way we are at the moment. So, you know, it is about hanging in there and sticking to it.
I think there was a report published that said that because of the global lockdown, we've reversed, or some estimates are saying we're going to reverse 30 years in terms of global poverty. And I guess one of the questions that comes around is, I mean, I don't think we would have been able to achieve a lockdown like this maybe pre the age of internet, but is there something in terms of like what's taking the test so long? So is it possible to do, because I know there was some temperature probes implemented, or is there a form of testing that can be developed? Because I know you said there's some shortages with the chemicals and things like that that can be developed to at least get people to be able to, you know, go out and about, and we can do, you know, a twice a week test or something to make sure that people who have the virus are captured.
Sure. So it's really important to kind of debunk a little bit about the obsession with testing, because I think we all kind of think there's going to be a magic test and it's going to say you either got it or you haven't, and therefore you can go outside. And
it's
unfortunately,
very like
it doesn't
work. I Am Legend, there was that little thing and they put it on your face and that was it.
Yeah, it's not going to be that. There's not going to be a barcode on your wrist that says I'm immune. and this is fine. So the reason for this is a couple. So one, the current test we have, which is basically a giant cotton wool bud that gets shoved right up the back of your nose. It's a really uncomfortable test to have done. Is looking for the virus itself. That's what's called a PCR test. And that's most accurate in the first couple of days of you having symptoms, but it still has about a 20 to 30% false negative rate. So 20 to 30% of people have the test, they're told they haven't got coronavirus, and they actually have. Partially that's because the virus, when it starts in your body, lives in the bottom of your lungs, and the cotton wool bud only goes in the back of your nose. And partially it's also because there might not be enough virus around there for it to catch on the end of the cotton wool bud. So, you know, it's an okay test, but it's not a perfect test. Secondly, and then the second type of test, which is what we're kind of all waiting for, is the antibody test that shows you've had coronavirus and you've got some immune response. Now, what we don't know yet is how long that immunity lasts. It could be days, it could be weeks, it could be months, it could be years. We don't know. And there's a lot of work going on around the world to do that. Now, to date, no one has developed an accurate antibody test that has passed the UK government's kind of criteria. And there's a real risk with the antibody test that if we tell someone they've got antibodies and they go out and get coronavirus, they won't know, they'll think it's not coronavirus, they won't take it any more seriously, so they'll carry on spreading it and they won't stay at home. And two, it gives them that full sense of security and they go and do things that they shouldn't put themselves at risk. So we haven't got the antibody test yet, and the test we have for whether you've got the virus or not is not perfect. So I think we're still, probably weeks, possibly months away from the antibody test. What you will start to see over the next couple of weeks is the increase in the number of people that we can test. And that's really more about being able to say, if you're self-isolating in a house where someone is symptomatic, which you'd need to do for 14 days, if we can test the symptomatic person in the first couple of days of their symptoms and tell you it's not COVID, it's hay fever or something else, then you can go back to work as an essential worker. So that's the priority of the testing that you'll see first. And then later on, you'll see more testing, and that will be to try and understand the spread of the virus. But until we have the antibody test, we're unlikely to have that kind of wristband barcode that says you've had it, you're okay.
Sorry, go on.
Why do you think that, you know, this is the case in the UK, and there are other countries, for example, where you've seen, they've been much more prepared when it comes to testing, and the situation of in certain other countries, of course, very few, that have kind of managed better. So Germany, as an example, South Korea, as an example, what have they done differently, or what was available to them that was different, and what can we learn from them?
No, it's a good question and one we get asked about a lot. So Germany is a bit easier to begin with. So Germany has more of the type of testing labs than anywhere else, as far as I know, in Northern Europe. So the labs that do these tests, the PCR labs, are a particular type of lab. And we haven't got a lot of them, frankly. So that was a limiting factor to begin with in the UK and for most of the rest of Europe. The second thing is that the chemicals, what are called the reagents that you need to do the tests, are made in Germany, a large proportion of them. So, of course, they were able to just nab them as soon as they came out of the factory, whereas we were waiting in the queue. So there's been that's been one of the reasons for the delay. I think there was a really good analogy someone gave the other day that, the national testing program are the kind of great battleships. And what the government's also been doing is working with all the small boats alongside and all the individual laboratories, whether they're in universities or businesses, to help them ramp up to join the testing battle. So it's a kind of combination of little boats and big battleships in terms of our approach. The delays have been about getting the chemicals and getting the kit and the people trained to use the kit. And there's been a massive engine doing that. We have moved from kind of 500 tests a week to 10,000 tests a day. over less than a month. I mean, you know, that is quite astronomical.
That is phenomenal.
When we started, we were in a different position. You know, Korea is a bit like Germany in terms of they had a lot of diagnostics. They do a lot of the work across the world developing that kind of diagnostic test, so they were able to move faster as well. So that's the big difference you're seeing in testing, is the baseline position was different. And you know, what we have to kind of recognize as well is when this started back at the beginning of December, and it's really important, you know, less than 6 months ago, I think it was this week, we were 100 days since the first case was reported to the World Health Organization from Wuhan. We didn't know whether this would be like SARS, a relatively small number of cases across the world, or MERS, which was the Middle Eastern equivalent of SARS. You know, both are coronaviruses, and we had nowhere near this level of spread. So, you know, you can understand from a government's perspective where you look at this and kind of go, where's it going? And then what happened really over the kind of tail end of January, I think it was, and into February, was the spread into Iran, followed then by the spread into Italy. And it was really the Iranian growth that made the world kind of wake up to what was going on. And until we really saw spread outside of China into Iran and then into Southern Europe, most countries were waiting because this could have burnt out quite quickly like SARS or MERS did. And so, you know, I think it's reasonable. I mean, I'm sure afterwards there'll be a whole load of inquiries and documentaries and everything else of coulda, woulda, shoulda. Bluntly, I think the civil service in its entirety, both at local and national level, have moved heaven and earth, and there are things that have been achieved in weeks that previously have taken decades in terms of changing the way we do stuff.
Yeah, so I mean, this topic's been it's occupied, you know, every aspect of our lives, and a lot of people following it, and especially young people, you know, listening to podcasts such as these, and you know, listening to the news, they might be interested in public health after this whole crisis. And I know, as a medical student myself, I know some of my colleagues, you know, had never given a second look at, you know, public health lectures or infection medicine or anything else. What advice would you give to, you know, young people that are aspiring to get into public health or infection medicine?
Yeah, I think it's definitely made us the new specialism of interest. I'm not sure we're going to overtake plastic surgery for medical students, but who knows? We'll see. So public health is a specialism in which you can enter both as a doctor or as a non-medic. So we have a multidisciplinary training program. People generally do a master's in public health, and then we train for 6 years, 5 to 6 years as in this multi-professional way to become consultants. There are a whole range of different things that sit in public health. So you can be an infectious disease specialist, a health protection specialist in public health, or you can be more of a generalist like myself and be a director of public health or a consultant who works in a local authority. Or you can work in Public Health England, which I used to do before I came to Birmingham. What I would say is, if you're interested, have a look at the Faculty of Public Health website or the Royal Society of Public Health website. Both have got a lot of information. The other thing is, not everyone needs to be a consultant. There are lots of specialist jobs in public health. You know, I have a team of around 60, 70 people now. Of those, only 4 of us are public health consultants, and everyone else are specialists in public health. So there's lots of ways to get involved and lots of different career paths. So I'd say definitely go out, do a bit of Googling, have a bit of reading, and go do it. We definitely need more people that get involved in public health. It's a great job, and you can have, you know, most of the time it's a lot of fun. It's not mass mega disasters, you make a difference at scale. And for me, that's why I came into public health. I could have stayed a GP and helped the world one person at a time. here I get the privilege of helping a city of 1.1 million people.
Through campaigns and through public health awareness.
Yeah, well, through all sorts of things, and whether it's changing policy to the way that we design the city to make it easier and to get around the city on foot or by bicycle, whether it's working with our food system to make it easier for people to get affordable, healthy, ethical, and culturally appropriate food, whether it's working with our faith institutions to help work with our scholars to understand health in the context of faith. If we get it right, over a million people benefit, and they live lives in which they can achieve their potential. And that's the huge privilege of this. You know, there's a little bit of me that's megalomaniac and loves a game of risk as well. But ultimately, actually, this is about making the world a better place, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you.
We've talked about a bit about the lockdown and the kind of negative effects, and a lot of people, especially young people, starting to lose patience. I just wanted to ask, because I was reading, I was watching an interview with Professor Carol Sikora, who was the ex-director of the WHO cancer program, and he was kind of suggesting his kind of exit strategy, and he was kind of saying that by the end of April we'll have we should lift up the lockdown by the end of by mid-May we should allow most key workers back in and small businesses to be up and running. And by the end of May or beginning of June, we should see everything kind of fully running back to normal and normal life to resume as early as mid-June. I'm assuming that's quite controversial to be saying. And what are your thoughts, and what is your kind of suggested exit strategy for COVID-19?
Yeah, so I think we're all watching at the moment what's happening in China and what's happening in Italy. So China have reopened businesses and reopened transport in the country. Italy have literally just started to open up some small businesses as well. And you've got to keep in mind, you know, China obviously is about 6 weeks ahead of where we are. Italy's at least 2 to 3, probably 4 weeks ahead of where we are. What we're really concerned about is if you open up too soon, which we know in the 1918 epidemic, some cities did, and what they saw was this second peak come afterwards, and that really drove much larger numbers of deaths. A lot larger number of cases. So I don't think you will see much movement in the UK until probably mid-May at the earliest. I'd be very surprised if we get more. I'm always happy to be proved wrong, but I think mentally get your head into a space that we won't be back to normal before June, and even then it will be a weird normal. And when it does start, it will start very, very cautiously. It may be opening up of some additional shops, for example, so extending the shopping capacity because that's a relatively small workforce.
Restaurants,
it might
hopefully
be allowing. I think it's unlikely restaurants would be a first wave because in restaurants it's very difficult to get the physical distancing. So what they might do is open up some things, but you'll need the same kind of approach you have in the supermarket. So it might be your local corner shop's open, but it's only one person in, one person out because it's too small a store. So you might see that kind of thing. You might see schools open up a bit more. We know this virus doesn't harm children in the way that it does adults, as often younger children. So that might be an approach they might start to do. They might open up more transport to allow people to move around the country again, to kind of get back to family, so where people have been isolating separate from family. And it may be that they open up in waves. So we might have a weekend in which you're able to go, if you want to move from where you are to somewhere else in the country, there's this 24, 48 hours in which you can get a bus or a coach or a train and go, and then they lock it down again and see what's happened. But to be honest, I think until we see what happens in Italy and in China, no one's going to make any commitment. And I really say, get your head in the space. We're going to be doing this till June. And if we get out early, fabulous. But if you pretend it's going to be over by the middle of April or the end of April, I think that's a mistake.
one of the, I guess, I have a couple of close-up questions because I feel like we're at a point now where we can, this is getting very interesting and I think there's a lot more to dig into. In the UK, we didn't leave restaurants running as takeaway or in a large extent, whereas in some other countries they did that. Was there a specific driver? Is there something different here, or is that issue that social distancing is very difficult inside restaurants, even in a takeaway format?
So we have left, most restaurants can still act as a takeaway.
Okay.
There is very specific guidance for restaurants on how they can still function as a takeaway, how they can keep their staff safe if they're working in the kitchen. It depends a bit on the kitchen space, and the way that the restaurant works. So certainly in Birmingham, you know, a large number of independent restaurants have moved to a takeaway provision. You know, I got a veg box delivered today from Baked in Brick, and I got some cheeses delivered from Curds and Whey, which are both independent retailers in Birmingham. But in terms of staying open as restaurants or cafes, that closed the same time as everyone else in lockdown. And that's because you can't go and sit on a table in most restaurants 2 meters away from someone. You're normally about a meter to a meter and a half max between tables, and that's too big a risk.
But I've just realized that I made a terrible mistake. I thought all restaurants were closed, including takeaways. So I've been quite upset, but it's good to know.
You need to get online, mate. You're missing out.
that's the first one. I had another question that I wanted to ask before we close off is there, I know that there's an age demarcation. So the virus tends to target older people more severely, although that's not like a hard and fast rule. There are a lot of young people that are affected as well, but certainly in percentages. There was also discussion around Muslim communities that, or BAME, black and minority ethnic communities that we're being targeted disproportionately, or for whatever reason, we seem to be more susceptible to the virus. Is there any truth to this on a wider level, numbers wise?
Sure, let me pick the two up separately. So first off, we know that the older you are, the more vulnerable you are for this virus killing you. And we just got to be really blunt about that. So we know that the proportion of people over 80 who are in hospital coronavirus who die is much, much higher than the proportion who die that are under 30. And that's because of your health status in general. We also know that if you've got existing severe illness or you have a compromised health response, so you're immunocompromised because you have an organ transplant or you have serious lung disease, you also fare a lot worse. So we know that, and that plays out in every country pretty much the same pattern. Actually, the elderly and those with health conditions are more likely to die. But that doesn't mean everyone else doesn't have a risk. And sadly, we are seeing younger people die across. What we're also seeing is healthcare professionals, particularly in Italy, died. And that probably is a reflection of exhaustion. So we know that when you're working all the hours there are, you are exhausted. That depletes your body's ability to fight back. It impairs your immune system. We think that's what was happening in Italy. So that's kind of the patterns of age perhaps that we're seeing. The ethnic minority difference is a slightly different situation. So there are two things that are going on there. In the UK context, we don't have that evidence yet. We're trying to get it. There's a lot of work looking at the data to try and do the analysis. What we are seeing internationally, particularly in America, is that particularly Afro-Caribbean communities in America are massively overrepresented in the cities, in the death statistics. So there are two things that might be going on. One is we know that there are many health conditions that are more common in ethnic minority communities. So South Asian communities often have higher levels of diabetes. Cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure is more common in Afro-Caribbean communities and in South Asian communities. For example, all of those put you at higher risk if you do catch coronavirus of having a worse outcome. The second thing that, which is particularly true in the US, not so true in the UK, is that ethnic minority communities in the US are less likely to have health insurance, are less likely to have access to general practice or their equivalent. And so, you know, when their access to health when they do get sick is only really to go to the emergency room when they're really, really sick. So they don't present very early. They kind of struggle on until it's absolutely disastrous, and then they go to the emergency room. And then, of course, they'll have worse outcomes as well because they're presenting late. I think what we're seeing is, you know, this virus is, you get worse outcomes with this virus if you have worse health. And we've known for ages that there is worse health in some of our ethnic minority communities, and that's tied into poverty, to disadvantage, and to marginalization. In the UK, we may see some of this. Where you're really seeing it is in countries like the US, where private health insurance is really creating a barrier for people accessing as well.
It's definitely something to think about. There's one thing I also wanted to ask you. Of course, every single Thursday, it's becoming almost like a ritual where we're applauding the NHS and you know, everyone who's on the front line battling this deadly virus. But what else can people like me and Thaqib do to help the NHS?
Ahmed?
He's a doctor, isn't he? So he's fighting already. Okay, fine, Ahmed as well. So what can we do other than just clapping to help the NHS?
No, it's a good question. So the things I would ask everyone to do, first of all, stay home. Only go out when it's essential. And when we say stay home, that means stay in the house you live in with the people you live with in that house. It doesn't mean popping next door to the neighbours or to granny who lives around the street. It is staying in the house in which you live. You can use the garden. You can use a balcony if you have one. Only go out to do essential shopping and only go out for a short period of exercise. We really say under an hour, and try to do that exercise in the mile circumference around where you live. So no more than a mile away. This is not the time to be getting in the car and driving off to the South Downs or out to Lickey Hills to go and have picnic. It's about doing physical activity for a short period of the day to get some physical activity every day. Those things are the things that help our NHS most. It stops the infection spreading. It stops people needing intensive care. It stops people dying. The other thing that I would ask everyone to do is to pick up the phone. You know, don't just send a text or a message on WhatsApp. Have a conversation. One of the things that will hit us hard through this is the impact on mental health. Actually reaching out and making contact with people, having those conversations makes such a difference. It really brightens someone's day, and that will help us in the long run, because there will come a period where it's not so much the physical health issues that are impacting on the NHS, but it's the severe mental health burden of this as well. So stay home, stay safe, stay connected to other people, but not physically connected. Now's the time to practice on your telephone conversations.
I think that's a very nice kind of way to end on. I'll add on one little plug at the end of that, is that, you know, pick up your phone and start listening to podcasts, ideally the Middle West podcast. Really appreciate your time. And I think we've gotten a lot of kind of a different outlook. So what we've been trying to do over the past few episodes is give our listeners kind of every aspect of it, and the public health point of view has been really, really valuable. Hopefully we can have you on again at a future date, hopefully, to talk about something less grim. With that, I'd like to say to everyone, you can email us with any feedback, any guest ideas, any concerns that you have, on podcast@themiddlewest.co.uk. You can listen to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can like us on Facebook at the Middle West PC, Instagram, Twitter, engage with us, tell us what we're doing right, tell us what we're not, recommend new guests, etc. And we hope to be back very soon with another episode. Hopefully we have another couple planned in the coronavirus series. And we've got a team member potentially down. He's ill, but potentially coronavirus, potentially not. So hopefully he's doing well. Thankfully it doesn't seem to be too bad.
Stay at home, guys. Stay at home.